Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Practical spirituality. Positive messages. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from a balmy day in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome esteemed author and professor, Dr. Richard Katz, to the show. Dr. Katz received his PhD from Harvard University and taught there for 20 years. He's also a professor at the First Nations University of Canada and an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of Saskatchewan. And for over 50 years, Richard has lived and worked with Indigenous peoples in Africa, India, the Pacific, and the Americas. His latest book is entitled Indigenous Healing Psychology, Honoring the Wisdom of the First Peoples. And in some ways, it's a summation of all his studies and insights. And we'll take a look at the book today. So it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome Dr. Richard Katz to the show. Welcome, Richard.
Yeah, it's really good to be here with you. Yeah.
All right. It's a big book. There's a lot of information in the book, isn't there? And it's a bit of a scholarly tome. I know it wasn't, it's not ultimately scholarly, not like a text, but it's certainly underpinned with a lot of scholarly research. So that makes it quite interesting. You talk in the early parts of the book about your own education and the paradigms of Western psychology and some of the ways maybe that those paradigms don't serve us that well. And there are shifts from some of the ways we used to approach psychology, right, in recent decades. But just tell us a little bit about that, about your background and where you're coming from in terms of your psychological approach.
Yeah, good. You know, the first thing I want to mention is I'm so glad you mentioned the length of the book. When you work on something that's a culmination of more than 50 years of research, it's hard to make it short. But what I tried to do, and I think you've hit the nail on the head, is that there's a very strong underpinning of research data and so forth, but it's mostly in footnotes. I really explored a whole new way of writing, which was to put all that more technical material in footnotes. So I think that when people go through the book, they will find it to be a good read, and those who want to pursue more of the background data will find it mostly in the footnotes. I think the footnotes are almost 20% of the book. So that was a conscious effort. And I appreciate the fact that there'll be different people looking at the book. And some of them want that, and some of them will want just the read through.
Right. So, and unlike some people that put their footnotes at the back of the book, you know, you've chosen to put yours on the page itself, which is easier for it to read. I always find it a little tedious to have to go back and forth all the time. Makes it more user-friendly, certainly. Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I already have a very good feeling about this interview because it's clear not only that you looked at the book, but you know what it's about. So that makes me feel very comfortable.
So, I think it's unfortunate when people interview folks and haven't read the book. So it's really hard to talk about anything, meaningful.
I've had that experience. So, yeah, the beginning of the book really was the beginning of my work as a psychologist. I went into psychology with the idea of trying to be of service to others, to help others. You know, kind of naive. I think that's what many of us are doing. I think that's clearly your work. But sometimes it's hard to find the vehicle. What is the way that we can do that? And somehow I landed on psychology. And I think I had the notion that psychology was there to help people. Well, I went to Harvard to get my degree in clinical psychology. And what I discovered is that mainstream psychology, the one thing it doesn't really do is teach us how to heal.
Right.
So I had quite an experience there. In the book, I talk about some of my teachers and colleagues, Abe Maslow and Eric Erickson, people like that. And then I also had the unusual experience in my graduate school of working with Tim Leary and Dick Alpert in the LSD era. So I had quite a broad and deep experience in psychology, but really not really learning about healing. And it wasn't until I went to the Kalahari Desert in 1968. That's a long time ago. 50 years.
I saw
what healing was really about. And there I saw indigenous people in community healing, actual healing work. And that changed my life forever as a psychologist. And then the journey, Paul, from then on, the next 50 years was how to bring those insights into psychology. And that's what I'm working on now. That's what the book is about, but also those insights into how to live. I mean, psychology is not just an academic discipline, it's how do we live? I think that's what you work on, I think, in your work.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing about academia is that, you know, the academic approach is finding out more and more about something rather than knowing the thing itself, right? I mean, there's a difference between experiential knowledge, direct perception, direct experience, and an academic study of that, you know. And I think both are relevant, aren't they? We need both, but that... when you've got an applied subject like psychology, which obviously, you know, its raison d'etre is to be applicable, that then, you know, academia kind of falls short a little bit because we need that more holistic approach. So I think, you know, this is an ongoing tussle, really, between, you know, the human endeavor for greater knowledge base, right, the academic approach, but also human endeavor for, you know, the experience of it. Obviously, the indigenous peoples are more interested, I would say, and that seems to come through in the book, you know, in the direct experience, right, rather than codifying various categories of understanding and et cetera. Because, you know, unfortunately, who was it that said the map is not the territory? I mean, you can have a wonderful map, but it's, you know, you're still nowhere near to experiencing what it's like to be out and about in nature, right? You know, there's limits to the map, however detailed it might become.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that you've hit the nail again on the head. I'm so happy to be talking with someone that gets what I was trying to get at. Because what I found with psychology, and I'm talking not just about academic, but also the practitioners. You know, we've all been in touch with psychologists, you know, to help in terms of therapies and other things. Is there's a preoccupation with getting it right according to their. So, like, for example, in therapy, the emphasis is so much on the therapist and their technique as opposed to the person who's coming in for help who's really expert in their own issues. And the book is really trying to put the emphasis back on our own experience. You know, we are not ignorant of what happens to us, right? And as long as we give power over to those people who claim to be authorities, we're not going to get very far. And the beautiful thing about working with indigenous knowledge, and that's what the book is really trying to do, is the emphasis always is on our own experience. That's primary. That's almost sacred. So one of the teachings, and the book talks about this, is that the most important data, the most ultimate truth, is our story, our personal story.
Right.
And you can imagine how psychology would feel like very uneasy with that, because that says that we are experts in our own life story. And so the psychologist and the therapist and the counselor then becomes a co-worker rather than expert fixing things.
Right.
And academic psychology is uncomfortable with it too, because how do you measure experience?
I think, you know, in common parlance in Unity, for instance, in our particular endeavor, you know, in the Unity movement, you know, we would say that sometimes the idea of story can trap us, right? We could be trapped into our own limited story of who we are, right? And so we want to break through that story. But as Pema Chodron and other teachers, you know, especially in the Buddhist tradition, you talk about it in the book, everything's for learning. So even our blocks, even the things that we see as our problem, right? They're actually a way through if we could see it from a different point of view. And so rather than see our story as something that limits us, we notice that, oh, well, okay, there are blocks here. Well, let's look at this. You know, how is this happening? And then ask our wisdom mind, our wisdom heart to give us some insight into that. I think that teachers, obviously, in the indigenous tradition, teachers are important, right? And we tend to throw out the baby with the bathwater sometimes because we could do it all ourselves, you know, and that's not always the case, right? We need teachers to help us draw out the inner wisdom. I mean, I guess in the true sense of the word educate, right, to draw forth that inherent wisdom we already have.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that point about stories. That's a really good point because the teachings in the book from indigenous elders I've worked with, when they talk about our personal stories being the ultimate data, the ultimate truth, it's not a fixed story. Like, for example, if I were to tell you my story, my life story, and then later I were to tell you my life story, there should be differences because I'm a different person. You know what I'm saying? It's not a recounting of an old, well-traveled, well-replayed story. It's a creation in the moment. So I think it's really an important point you're making is that we can be trapped by our stories if we hold on to what is comfortable. But the teaching in the book is not to hold on to what's comfortable, but to connect to what is. It's almost the isness, you know? And that's our story. And for example, when you go to a sweat lodge, which I talk about in the book, it's your story of that particular experience. Okay? And it might be different a week later. So it has that dynamic quality. And it's not codified, as you mentioned. It's not regularized. It's happening each time. And a lot of times in psychology, they say, oh, wait a minute now. That's not what you said a week ago, or that's not what you said a year ago, but that's exactly the point. It couldn't be what it is. One of the persons I worked with, name is Danny Muskwa, you know, like the elders up here, and the book talks about this. They have certain stories they tell. And sometimes there's a limited repertoire, and sometimes you're sitting down with an elder and you say, oh my, you know, inside, oh my God, here comes the bad story, you know. And you can tune off because you say, oh, my God, I've heard that story before. But what Danny Muskwa said is every time you hear a story, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a different place, and there are slight differences in the story. So if you shut off, you miss the point.
And even if there aren't any differences, you are different, so you're bringing a different perspective to it, right? I think about the teachings of Jesus, you know, the true teachings of Jesus, not what they've made up about him, but the wisdom stories in the Gospels, you know, I mean, we've all read them many, many times. I certainly have. And yet they're endlessly fascinating, you know, and I always get more out of them each time I read them, which is exactly to your point, right? And because they have that depth psychology to them, you know, they have that depth spirituality that is fresh every day. I think that's true of Zen teachings or Buddhist teachings as well, right? The pointing to a totally different way of perceiving reality. Let's put it like that.
Yeah. You know, there was a time I was in it was a group for AA, not myself, but a family member, Al-Anon. And there was this one gentleman that came to the meetings. Every week, his story was almost word for word the same, if not word for word, maybe 95%. And I remember the second week, the third week, starting to turn off, waiting for the fireworks story. You know, in various support groups, we have firework stories. You know, someone discovered someone who wouldn't not supposed to be there, and you know, whatever. And then I remember Danny's teachings. And the third week, even though the words that this guy used were almost the same, I tried to listen, because this is how he wanted to present himself. Maybe it was the continuity he was seeking. Maybe he was struggling to maintain balance. You know, we don't know.
Eh? Right.
He didn't turn off. And that's the most important thing. Like here, like I'm talking to you, we haven't met before. But for me, this is a real moment. You know, you're there and I'm here. And I'll tell you something about this book is like, and I think I want to mention this, all the author royalties go back to the people. So I promote this book with a clean heart, because I'm not in my own life. I don't have I don't even have a website, eh? Because I'm at that point in my life where I'm just, I've got plenty to do. I'm helping to raise a grandchild. So I've done my thing. The book has got to speak on its own. So it's kind of like, how do we connect to each other? And we're doing this right now. And I'll bet that many of your listeners have the same relationship to you that you're seeking to talk about, even though it's electronic. I don't know. Is this, you probably get all your feedback, eh? But I think that's what the book is trying to do, is to connect people and not to promote, not to argue, not to sell anything, but just to tell a story.
Mm-hmm. And
I hope that people find it of help, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating read. And it's a fascinating read if you're a regular sort of Western psychologist that wants to see some of the other points of view, you know, and how, and the correspondences, the ways there's interconnection with indigenous understanding, and you know, like you say, you go far afield, right, from the Kalahari Desert to, you know, Saskatchewan or whatever, and other points around the planet in terms of talking to indigenous teachers. And part of the thing that fascinates me most is, and it speaks to what we just talked about, and that's the mystery idea, right? Respecting mystery. Because there's no way we can know, you know, the Buddhists say, you know, it's don't know mind. And in the West, we want to know everything, right? We want to have control over it. Because if we think we know, then we have control. And as you, one of your chapters says, if you can't measure it, is it real? You know, well, there's so many things that we can't measure. And in fact, we know very little, right? I mean, I think it's the healthiest thing we can say is that I know nothing, basically. Because then we're wide open, right? We are abandoning all the things we think we know so that we can allow the true mystery to infuse us. And I think it seems that's the commonality with all indigenous teachers, is that they are able to do that, right? They're able to be part of that flow, if you like.
Exactly. You're right on. I like, for example, in the book, it talks about research and the paradigm. The way research goes in mainstream psychology is that we can pin things down, and if we haven't pinned them down yet, meaning categorize, measure, weigh, whatever, it's because our measures are not yet developed. But give us time and give us energy and maybe some funding, and we will come up with a way to measure. But from an indigenous point of view, it will never happen, because the mystery, this is the teaching, the mystery remains. So you imagine, you know, a mainstream psychologist who's dedicated to measuring, to finding out things are real if you can measure them with a scale or a questionnaire, being told, you know, there's a part you'll never measure. And actually, that's the main part.
Right.
It remains. So it's ultimately frustrating for a mainstream psychologist, unless they can open themselves to the idea that it's great to measure certain things. It's fine to try to use that, but we always have to respect the spiritual dimension. What is the mystery? And the mystery remains. And that's a beautiful teaching, you know, and I go by that. When I teach psychology, I go through a text, and I say, this is beautiful, this is fine, but it has limits.
Right.
It has limits.
And, you know, and not to contradict what you just said, because I believe it and I live from that, but I think I'm thinking about, say, Newtonian physics and then quantum mechanics or whatever, quantum physics, and the fact that you can't even ask certain questions until you know that there's a quantum worldview, right? Yeah. When you're stuck in a Newtonian worldview, there's only so many things you can ask the mystery. But when you're in a quantum field understanding, then you can ask the mystery more, if you like. So therefore, the expanse of knowledge, the fact that it's unfolding, can be useful, right? In the sense that now we've got a greater field that we can look at, just a greater spectrum, what's possible. So in that sense, it's useful, I think. We pushed it a little further. But even so, there's probably a next level beyond quantum understanding that would make quantum seem rather, trivial and childlike. I don't know. Yeah. So, there's levels and levels. But I think they nest in each other, right? Again, the academic and the direct experience, can help each other. They don't always, unfortunately. They're mutually distinct, but I think we can. And the part of what you're trying to do in the book is to say, look, there's an invitation here that it can be a both and, right? There could be another way of looking here.
That's, again, you've got it, an invitation. I think one of the most, one of the things I really enjoyed hearing, there was a psychologist that read the book, fairly mainstream. And what he said was, it's a wonderful book to read. The first thing I have to say, he told me, is I never felt attacked or insulted. That's so important. I find it easy, probably, to criticize. It's almost like second nature. That's not good enough, or you're doing it the wrong way. The hard part is to respect all points. Mm-hmm. Not to say that's what I believe, but respect it. And so the book is trying to say to psychologists and people who use psychology, again, that's almost everybody, psychology has the thing it can do, but certain things it can't. And let's not just say it's bad, because there are some things that we can learn that are very powerful. But let's add to it. And the interesting thing about what we add is it's what psychology can't do and other things can.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You see, psychology, when it was developing, said no more religion, no more philosophy, we're going to be a science.
Mm-hmm.
That was a terrible mistake. Because it threw out all the interesting questions. The philosophical questions, the religion, the experiential questions.
Right. Well, it's all part of a rationalist thrust, I guess.
That's right.
Encompass all knowledge, in a nice format.
Major or what?
I'm sorry?
Are you a philosophy major or what?
No, my degrees are in English, actually, though I did do some philosophy. But it's a fascinating subject, and in many regards, all religion, or certainly spirituality, is philosophy. I mean, it's a mixture of psychology and philosophy. I mean, I believe Jesus was a great master psychologist, and understood deeply the nature of our human condition and also our spiritual limitless nature. So, that's the joy of really. I think Jesus was a Zen master, right? Actually, that masquerading as a first century Jew, but if you approach him like that, you see the teachings are really, really quite profound. They're not to do with morality as much as they are to do with awakening, deep understanding, deep presence, if you like.
Yeah, it's a bit like when I worked with the indigenous elders. I see them as our first psychologists.
Right.
And because as a human community, they gathered and they had to solve the issues that psychology, you started out the very start of your program. Psychology is meant to teach us how to live.
Mm-hmm.
Not the only thing, but that's its purpose. It's supposed to serve us.
Right.
For psychologists, these indigenous people and all over the world, they had to face those issues of how do we work together? How do we live together? How do we have balance? How do we heal? So they're really our first psychologists. And then the elders that I've worked with are in that lineage. And that's really what I've done for the past 50 years. And that's what the book is about. It's these indigenous teachings. And like you said at the beginning, it's not just psychology, it's how to live.
Right.
It's a book about how to live. Because that's what psychology is about.
Unfortunately, you know, and you mentioned this a number of times in the book, you know, the psychology has become a disease-based, you know, paradigm. And you mentioned the DSM manual, you know, when it first came out was like 100 pages. Yeah. Now it's 8 times that many. Yeah. There were 84 conditions and syndromes. Yeah. Now there's hundreds, you know. Yeah. You know, how did that happen in such a short period of time? You know, unless there's some kind of, I don't know, manipulative thing going on there that doesn't seem to be, you know, the most healthy, actually. And yet, you know, it's very difficult to say, well, all that's made up. You know, some people say, oh, well, these are made up syndromes, whatever. But that's sort of suspect, isn't it? When because who are you? You know, you're not a trained psychologist or psychiatrist to dare to argue with this Bible, really. You know, the DSM-5, whatever it is, what's it up to now? Like I said, like this holy book, really, you know, unfortunately.
You know, that DSM, we can talk a little more about that. I'd like to kind of like, just as you say, you can't throw it out, but it has very limited function, focusing on problems and how to fix them.
Right.
But life is more than fixing problems. It's also growing. It's also experiencing. So I've got some ideas about that DSM.
Okay. I'm hearing the music, folks. That means we're going to the break. I'm with Richard Katz. We're talking about his book, Indigenous Healing Psychology. Listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. See you then. All right.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
It takes you to power Unity Online Radio. If you'd like to make a positive difference in the world, you can by contributing to this global ministry. Unity Online Radio relies on listeners like you to support our broadcasts that send our messages out to an awakening world. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate today.
Here's a Unity Mindful Moment with Catherine Ponder, taken from a classic talk called The Prosperous Truth, recorded at Unity of Austin in 1991.
God is extravagant supply. Get that, extravagant. God is extravagant supply. He brings forth the best robe. He spreads a banquet table, as we saw last night, with good things on which we may feast. He overflows our cup. He opens the windows of heaven and pours out a blessing. And then this is what that Unity Correspondence Course said. Why are you satisfied with such meager living when you may have so much?
To find out more about Unity teachings, visit unity.org.
Did you know Unity has published a new book by Eric Butterworth? This wonderful writer and teacher, who is loved by so many people, left a recorded class called Practical Metaphysics that has now been turned into a book. It's Vintage Butterworth. He explains how to live from a deeper state of consciousness and awaken to health, love, prosperity, and peace of mind. Practical Metaphysics. Find it online by going to unity.org and click Shop.
Take time out for you and join other like-minded souls looking to build their connection to spirit with the Unity at Sea Cruise in 2019. Experience a spiritual retreat at sea as you participate in a special program designed to help you on your individual journey of self-discovery. Deepen and explore your spiritual growth with Unity ministers and presenters as you enjoy exotic Caribbean ports of call. For all the details, go to unity.org/unityatsea now to make a deposit by January 30th and save $100.
Would you like to experience more peace and joy in your life through A Course in Miracles? Let Reverend Jennifer Hadley support you in discovering the powerful life lessons available through this unique spiritual thought system that teaches the way to love and peace is through forgiveness. Join Jennifer every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Central for A Course in Miracles, Living the Love, Walking the Talk, to experience the healing for yourself on Unity Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Call now with your question or comment, 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Richard Katz. We're talking about his book, Indigenous Healing Psychology, Honoring the Wisdom of the First Peoples. And this book ranges far and wide in terms of the world's indigenous traditions, but it also talks about Western psychology and how the two can fit together, the possibilities for the two. We were mentioning the DSM manual, the diagnostic manual that's used by the American Psychiatric Association and psychologists in general. And it's got good points and bad points, right?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing to talk about because basically you can't get help these days, particularly in the States. Of course, I'm Canadian, so we have a little different system. But in the States, you can't get help these days, psychological help, unless you are diagnosed with something.
Mm-hmm.
So the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, gives hundreds of diagnoses that you can be given. Mm-hmm. Depression, bipolar, and so forth and so on. Now, the point is this. the manual focuses on fixing problems, okay? So the insurance company will not reimburse your provider unless there's the diagnosis that they can say, oh, this person has, let's say, bipolar or depression,
right,
or anxiety disorder. So the various care providers have to give a diagnosis, but the diagnosis is focused on fixing a problem. Now, give me you have a loss, a personal loss. I've had this in my life recently without going into the details. And you grieve. You grieve in different ways. Like with me, I'm not open about it. It's with me all the time. It'll be with me for a lifetime. The Diagnostic Statistical Manual says our grieving process has to end after a certain point. Can't really be extenuated. We can't break down crying, which I do sometimes, because that's not the definition of grieving. So
mm-hmm.
And looking at grieving as a human experience, but we all grieve different ways. It defines what grieving should be, and it should have a certain limit. Once it passes that limit, it becomes a problem, a diagnosis, therefore therapy.
Right.
So the DSM, the Diagnostics, makes things into problems so that psychologists, psychiatrists can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Changing life issues into problems. Now, there are times where there really are problems. People are desperate. People are hurting. Therefore, they should get therapeutic help and medication when it's appropriate. I never want to underestimate the pain that people can feel.
Right.
That's true. But I want to emphasize how often what is really a human situation can be turned into a problem by the profession, and therefore they are allowed to fix it.
Right.
That's my critique of the, because could we have gotten much more disturbed in the last 20 years that all these diagnoses come up? I don't think so.
Well, then it gets extrapolated from there. You know, it becomes a societal norm, or it becomes a way that our social functioning looks at these things. So then an educational system and other systems, social systems are tailored to go along with this new way of looking at things, may not be healthy. And so before you know it, you know, we're stuck in a whole system that doesn't really serve us anymore, you know, and we wonder why the levels of our education are going down or whatever in terms of comparatives with other countries of the world. And it's a very disturbing thing, I think, because, you know, in the U.S., you're Canadian, but in the U.S., I think, you know, we have more prescription drugs than all other countries combined, et cetera, mm-hmm. you know, and this level of toxicity is unfortunately considered a little bit of a norm, you know. Gotcha. I wanted to mention earlier when we were talking about, you know, the difficulty with living a both-and existence. We're currently in a culture in our society, certainly in America, but also in the West, I think. We've just seen the abuse that other countries have received by our president. And this isn't a political show, but it's uncomfortable, you know, when allies like, you know, your own country are seen as almost enemies. And then we've got other folks who, you know, could do nothing wrong, whether it's Russia or whatever. This is highly disturbing, isn't it? Because it's throwing out the paradigm, maybe, but it's not necessarily a healthy way of doing it. Because we're creating and if everything's fake news, there's no sense of center anymore. I think it's very disheartening for many people that this is going on, and not sure what to do about it. Actually,
you know, I lived in the States for 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have dual citizenship. So part of me suffers along with you.
Right.
And here in Canada, of course, we can't make any sense of it other than that it's a form of madness. Eh?
Yeah.
But the thing is this, that you're so right in terms of how the norms can be created. Like take, for example, the use of Ritalin. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in schools, particularly in the lower, you know, the grade school up to grade 8, and even in high school, the main issue teachers face is not learning, but control of the classroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have kids, you know what it's like, particularly with boys. I mean, more than girls, I think. They're active, they're, you know. So the people I work with mostly are First Nations people. I teach at First Nations University, and I work with teachers who teach First Nations kids. So the teachers have a management problem. It's all over. The teachers prescribe Ritalin. And when you prescribe Ritalin to a group of people, First Nations people who have limited experience with pharmacological interventions.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, oh yeah, well, we better do it because the teacher says that.
Right.
The number of First Nations kids that are on Ritalin is enormous, way beyond non-First Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to be very clear. Some kids do need that Ritalin. They will benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
Norm of if someone is a little bit out of line, Ritalin is now what's happening.
Right.
To your point. So all of a sudden, we don't have classroom management problems anymore because we have Ritalin. And what happens to the kids?
Mm-hmm.
Again, there are certain kids that will benefit from it. And I want to be clear that this is not telling anyone who might be listening, don't use it.
Right.
It's very helpful for certain kids. But we have to be discriminating of not just saying, let's take it, but let's see, what are some of the alternatives? Like they, for example, one of the alternatives is good physical activity. Sports or tumbling, or, you know what I'm saying?
Stuff we don't do these days because we're looking at a screen all the time, you know.
That's what the book is trying to talk about, how to live a life that where, again, spirituality at the center. That's the first chapter that talks about psychology. It's spirituality. And one of the things I wanted to mention was that One of the things that psychology is afraid of when you say this is spirituality. Wait a minute, we can't, that's that, God comes down and...
Right, kind of nebulous, isn't it?
That's right. But what the teachings that I've gotten is that spirituality is every day. Like this morning, I walked to get my coffee. It's a beautiful day up here. The trees, you know how trees are? It's a beautiful thing. I'm always amazed. We have big trees up here, okay? So mm-hmm. they start out at the bottom, firm, right? Roots are in the ground. They go up, and they go up, they go up. And it gets more and more vulnerable to things like the wind. And by the time you get to the top, the wind is blowing all those little things, that same tree. There's a teaching there. I don't know what it is. But I recognize, and that's the spirituality. Or we're talking, right? I don't know how you feel, but I feel connected, you mm-hmm. see? And that's the thing that psychology has to learn. It's not scary.
Mm-hmm.
It's just every day. And that's right. This teaching that's so powerful. So powerful. You alluded to it before, you know, like, what did you say? Jesus was a disguised as a, what did you, how did you put that? It was beautiful.
The idea he was a Zen master, you know, master psychologist, you know, disguised as a first century Jew. And you know, he was a Jew, but, and then we're not trying to deny that, right? He had a Jewish flavor and we love that about him. But he was so much more, right? He was one of the great world teachers,
very simple, right? Very simple. Nothing like bolts of lightning. And this is what psychology is afraid of, you see. And what I'm trying to say is that you can talk about spirituality as being the core. Like, I'll give you an example. When I do counseling, sometimes I'll reach a point, I just don't know what's happened. Now, the typical thing for a counselor is to cover that up and to kind of, you know, wing it until you get some sense of what's. But with me, what I do is I'll say to the person, you know, we're at a point now where I'm not sure what's happening. Do you have an idea?
Mm-hmm.
Person might say, I don't know. I'm feeling it. Because often it's the same feeling. That's mm-hmm. the actual connection.
Interesting.
We're trying to figure out where are we?
Mm-hmm.
You see, and rather than my pretending that I know, because I'm the expert, I share with them, I'm a little confused. I'm not sure what to do next. And oftentimes the person will say, I'm not sure either. Or sometimes they'll say, well, let's try this way. Okay, good. But we've met, you know, like we've encountered.
Right.
It's real.
Well, I think that's a key piece, isn't it, in terms of indigenous practice and also spiritual awareness, and that is to be present to what is, to be present to the now, you know, because, and you talk a lot about that in the book, this direct experience idea, because otherwise we're living, you know, not present, we're not being who we are at any given time, you know. Pema Chodron, who I love a lot, the great Buddhist teacher, you know, says abandon hope of any outcome, of any fruition. And it sounds like, oh my goodness, that's not the Western way. You know, I'm supposed to just got to get better and better all the time.
Yeah.
But what abandoning hope means, what I'm giving up is this idea I have of something working out a certain way, because I don't know if it's going to work out anyway, you know. So if I abandon hope to that, then what I'm saying is I'm giving up all those projections. And I can actually be present to what's happening, right? And in that moment, I may not know, like you said in that session, you know, you may not know right now exactly what it is, but we're on this journey. We're together. Here we are, you know, discovering this. And that is richer, isn't it, than trying to have a ready-made solution, you know, a toolkit for somebody that we can apply and then all will be well, you know, because I think all of us have a yearning to go a little deeper than that. You know, we want something that's truly authentic, you know. And I know many friends, of course, who've done sweat lodges and other traditions that are attracted to the Native American path, you know, whether they're Native Americans or not, but they have that yearning. But what I think they're yearning for is some sense of connectedness to the earth, to their own being, to something visceral, right? Something real in their lives. And and to get beyond thinking so much about things. And you have a lovely story about the sweat lodge where there was a German in there, and everybody's supposed to offer a prayer, right? And he said, well, I can only speak German, so maybe I don't need to offer a prayer. And the keeper of the sweat lodge said, well, you know, God understands all languages, you know, and, you know, this is good. Because really, the prayer is for ourselves, actually, isn't it? We're connecting with our own inner source, so it doesn't really matter if nobody else understands it. But a lovely story, because it speaks very much to what we're talking about, right? Yeah. Not to get lost in the fact, oh, I don't know the right words, I don't know how the story goes in that sense, you know. Trust the wisdom that you are, you know. You're German, you're valid, and so you're worthy to be in the sweat lodge right now.
Absolutely. That was the teaching. You know, I'll tell you another story. This is Joe Eagleup you're referring to, Lakota healer from Rosebud. So I went up for a vision quest, they call it a hambalecha. And part of the thing is at the end of the hambalecha, you come back to your community. People think of it as finding yourself. Well, no, it's finding your role in the community. It's beautiful. Right. Finding your role in the community. So part of the ceremony of welcoming you back from the hill, where you're up there without food or water, is you give gifts to the people who helped you. Okay. Mm. Joe Eagle Elk and Stanley Redbird, his helper, were the people that helped me directly.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was preparing before I went up on the hill, I had two very special gifts, one for Joe and one for Stanley. I'm sure you might even know the story because I can see you, the twinkle in your eye, okay? So I come back and there's a circle filled with people, many of whom I've never seen before, okay? And Joe and Stanley were there. And then a couple of the other people who I did know who were singers and help, but I would say half the people I had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Joe, when it came to, I said, how do I give the gifts? You know, I wanted to get some instruction on the protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, well, put the gifts in a pile and start with your left, pass the pile to your left, and it'll go around the circle. The first person on my left, I had no idea who he was. Guess what? He took one of the gifts. That was the special gifts. And then it went around. And maybe the third person took the second special gift. By the time it got to Joe and Stanley, there was something there, but not the special gift. That was the teaching. And what he said was, everybody who's here is in the community, and this is the community that supported you up in the hill.
Mm-hmm.
May not know them, but they're part of the community. What a teaching.
Right. Absolutely.
I was into this idea of individual gifts. Right. And the teaching was that everybody matters.
Well, you know, that very much Jesus is teaching again, isn't it? You know, what you did for the least of these, you did for me. Mm-hmm. And the fact, you know, in the parable of the vineyard, you know, the ones that started early in the morning received the same pay as the ones who started at 11 o'clock at night, you know, and they're all up in arms, the ones who worked all day, you know, come I get paid the same, you know, I've been working harder. But the thing is, you know, it's not about how many hours you put into this. It's about, you know, we're part of the whole, and we receive the blessing of the whole, all my relations. That understanding. Yeah. You know, in that regard, you know, sometimes people will put up horrible things about our president on Facebook, you know, I hate him or this, that, and the other, he's fat or whatever. And, you know, I've been writing, you know, he's not fat, he's my brother. You know, he may be fat, but that's not my business. You know, my business is to try and love him, even though I don't like him maybe and I don't agree with his policies. You know, that's valid, but I'm still called to love somebody because he is my relation, you know. And some people say, no, he's not my relation. He's not coming to my table. Well, again, we're missing the point here, right? That if we are to diminish ourselves, then go ahead and diminish somebody else. Because, you know, if we're connected in this way, then I can't afford to be hateful to somebody else, because that means really, in a sense, I'm hating myself, you know.
Absolutely.
It's
absolutely
tough, though, when you see somebody being egregious, you know, and doing horrible things, you want to attack them about it. So it's a tough one. It's a good lesson for us all in how to stay in our centered spiritual selves, you know, regardless.
Yeah. Yeah. The Dalai Lama, I think I talked about it in the book, I'm not sure, but the Dalai Lama said in one of his, this was a wonderful thing, he was being interviewed by Madonna. Madonna or someone like that.
Right.
Said, compassion for members of our family, our wife, our kids, that's not hard.
Right.
We are almost hardwired for that. He said, the main thing that I'd like to teach is compassion for our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, he said, you need training.
Yeah.
You need to learn acceptance. I thought that was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Not, like you say, not agreeing with.
Right. You don't have to agree with
Carl Rogers, there's a story in the book, Carl Rogers, when he was working with some of his trainees, he talks about empathy, you know, being in someone else's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the teachings, the indigenous teachings we talk about in the book. So Carl Rogers says that some of his trainees were very nervous in working with people who were really evil, pedophiles, murderers, because they afraid that by empathy they would be contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Contaminated. And Roger said to them, look, it's when you're working with people like that that you really must have empathy, because you are telling them, if you can have empathy, that you, in spite of what you've done, are still a human being. And by relating to you, I'm saying to you, you're part of the human race.
Right.
I don't have to say I agree with you, but I have to acknowledge that this is part of who we are. The dark side, right?
Absolutely.
Part of who we are. And to accept that is so hard. And that's what I was saying earlier. I find personally, it's so easy to criticize. I could have done in that book a whole critique of psychology that made every psychologist feel less than.
Right.
But what's the point? That's turning off people you want to influence.
Right. Very good.
And I'm not going to be dishonest and say, oh, psychology is wonderful. You see? So that's a hard one, though, isn't it? Eh?
And absolutely.
Mentioned the thing with Trump. I mean, that's like a hard one.
Well, you know, we end the book with a chapter. Remind me now, there's no one way, right? There's only
that's
there's
right.
many
only
right any ways. Good,
that's right. Yep.
And so that's what we're talking about, really. You know, it's what's the next right thing, as they say in the 12-step program, right?
Right.
You know, and that's true in our spiritual lives also. You know, what's the impeccable thing to do at this moment? Because then that's the only thing I can do, actually. I can project other things, but that's not real. But you know, all I can do right now is the next right thing. And the right ways are the ways that are following that, hopefully, impeccable path, right? That is non-judgmental.
The straight path, which is, and the beautiful thing, we talk about that in the book, I had to kind of be very clear, the straight path, which is what I learned in Fiji, which is one of the places I worked in, is not having a straight life trajectory. It's trying to be straight morally in your attitude, in your being. But my life course, and I'm not sure about you, but it's been a lot of
circuitous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the nice thing about a labyrinth, actually, is that, you know, you're you're on the straight path, even though it's circular, you know, even though it's going around and around. Yeah. And sometimes you get almost to the center, then you're out on the periphery again, then finally you get to the center. But your intention is to be on that straight path to the heart of something, right?
You know,
even though it takes you around along different ways.
One of the teachings of that that's so beautiful is that the further along you get on the path, and this is about healing, but it's also about living, the Fijian teaching, the further along you get, the more difficult it gets. Begin to feel that, in fact, you're on the path. As soon as you think you're on the path, guess what? That's when you fall off. Now, I'll bet that's what tightrope people feel. You know, as soon as they think about being on a tightrope,
right?
They're
not there anymore.
That's,
yeah.
And that's probably when they fall.
Yep.
So
that's why they call it the razor's edge, right? You know, it's edge. You know, it's a difficult path to walk, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can only do it with a light touch, basically. Light. You know, otherwise that razor is going to cut you deeply.
That's right.
You know?
And you know, yeah. It's also with the firewalking, same thing.
Yeah, right.
It's the light touch, and as soon as you think, "What? I'm walking on coals."
Yeah.
Get burned.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very good. All right, we're almost at the end of the show. If if there's something in 30 seconds you could impart to us, wisdom for today, what would that be, Richard?
Well, it's just the idea that each of us has within the core of spiritual knowledge and spiritual teachings that we have to honor.
Mm-hmm.
Acceptance of all ways and staying true to ourselves. That's what the book is about.
Right.
And taking the lead from indigenous people, but you can take the lead from many sources. Your
right.
show, others, you know, it's all there.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, I agree. It's a wise and compassionate read, folks. If you want to get hold of it, sure, it's available in all the usual outlets.
Yeah.
If you want to get hold of Richard, what's the best way get through to you?
John is Inner Traditions, which is my publisher. Inner Traditions.
Right. Right.
It's an author page.
And you don't have a website, you
no,
said?
No, I don't. I'm a, you know.
All right. So they can go to Inner Traditions, or it looks like you can go to Healing Arts Press as well.
Yeah. Well, Inner Traditions is the main one, yeah.
Yeah, this is an imprint of that. Okay, yes. Very good. And let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Richard. Next week, Buddhist and British meditation and mindfulness student and teacher Darren Coburn joins me. And he's going to discuss his book, Being Present, How to Cultivate a Peaceful Mind Through Spiritual Practice. So that's a nice little tag on to some of the things we've been talking about today. So he's coming all the way from Britain to be with us via the airwaves. So join us then. But right now, I want to thank very profusely Dr. Richard Katz for being present with us today. What a wonderful show. Thank you so much.
And I want to thank you for being present. It means a lot to me.
Yeah, well, good. And I hope I guess it's cooler up there in Saskatchewan, is it?
It's a beautiful day, Texas. Almost just 30 degrees centigrade.
That's warm, isn't it, for up there?
Yeah.
It's fairly flat, is it?
Oh, yeah. Not fairly, very.
Very flat. All right. Well, thanks again for being with us on Unity Online Radio and World Spirituality. And thanks, folks, for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.